Hello and welcome to Asia Inscripted. I'm Emily and this is the U.S. Asia Institute's summer podcast series where we cover key stories of the day with diverse speakers with firsthand knowledge of Asia. This summer's podcast series will focus on topics related to the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, which is composed of 10 member states including Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Laos, Malaysia, Myanmar, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. Our guests on this episode of Asia Inscripted are Roger Baker and James Borton. Roger Baker is the Executive Director of the Stratford Center for Applied Geopolitics at RAIN, a global center of excellence for geopolitical intelligence and analysis. Baker is one of the world's leading experts on North Korea and has dedicated extended periods of time living and working in and around the Korean Peninsula. His core emphasis is the multidisciplinary approach to geopolitics and the evolution of international relations to develop mid- and long-term forecasts to assist companies, governments, and other globally engaged organizations to make informed decisions. Baker holds a master's degree in military history from Norwich University, the oldest private military university in the United States. He has studied and worked in South Korea and graduated with honors from Southampton College, Long Island University. James Borton is a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies Foreign Policy Institute. He is also an independent environmental policy writer and former foreign correspondent for the Washington Times based in Hong Kong. He contributes regularly to Asia Sentinel, Asia Times, East Asia Forum, Geopolitical Monitor, Nikkei Asian Review, the South China Morning Post, Project Syndicate, and World Politics Review. He was a past National Endowment Humanities Fellow at Yale University. He has been a non-resident fellow at the Stimson Center and Tufts University Science Diplomacy Center, and has participated in numerous South China Sea conferences. He also co-founded the Mekong Environment Forum in Can Tho, Vietnam. His latest book, Dispatches from the South China Sea, Navigating to Common Ground, was published in 2021. He has a BA and an MA with honors in American Studies from the University of Maryland. To provide some context, the speakers mentioned the following acronym, UNCLOS, which stands for the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. Before we begin the episode, please be reminded that the U.S. Asia Institute is a nonpartisan, non-advocacy organization with no policy agenda. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official position of the U.S. Asia Institute. With that being said, let's move on to the discussion with Mr. Baker and Mr. Borton. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you, Mr. Borton and Mr. Baker, for joining us today. I first wanted to start by providing some context into our topic for today, which is the South China Sea Marine Survey, which both of you spearheaded. I'd first like to direct this question to Mr. Baker. I wanted to ask, what is the conflict at play within the South China Sea, and why does the South China Sea matter?
Well, let's take that in a backwards order. Let's talk about why the South China Sea matters, right? On an international scale, the South China Sea has somewhere estimated around a third of global shipping trade passes through the South China Sea every year. So right away, it's a very important route. You think about the ends of the South China Sea. You have Japan and Korea and China. Technically outside the South China Sea, but their goods moving back and forth from Europe and from the Middle East in particular and South Asia all moves through this space. So there, it's back in 2015 when they last did a count, it's about 12% of global fish catch just inside the little South China Sea. For some of these countries in there, 15%, 20% of their protein intake in a day comes from seafood. So it's a food security issue when we look at the area. It is also a place where, in part because of UNCLOS, the Convention on the Law of the Seas, there are actually large-scale now territorial overlapping claims, where in the past there was kind of a fuzzy central area that people moved around in. UNCLOS encouraged them to distinguish what was their territory and what wasn't. And that has created a lot of rising tension, both over geographic territory and over fishing territory. And finally, if we think about the South China Sea, it sits right along the southern frontier of Taiwan. And when you look at U.S.-Chinese competition, particularly in the region, access to the South China Sea, the East China Sea is critical for the United States to maintain its strategic security posture. And it's critical for China in many ways to push the United States out of the South China Sea and the East China Sea, treat it as their Caribbean, and secure their own interests within that geography as well.
Thank you so much for providing that context. That was really comprehensive. I wanted to direct the next question to Mr. Borton. Your survey looked specifically at the South China Sea's impact on regional fisheries, claiming that fishing is at the epicenter of conflicts at sea and inspires territorial ambitions. Mr. Borton, what did you identify as the trend or popular sentiment towards this from respondents? And were there any opinions or comments that opposed this?
Almost 75% of the respondents agree that there is an environmental security crisis in the South China Sea due to overfishing. And when looking at the environmental problems regionally, it is overfishing, illegal, unregulated fishing that stands at the top of the concern by far among all the respondents. The survey suggests that the South China Sea is at a tipping point because of the decades of fishing exploitation. To be clear, more than half of the fishing vessels in the world operate in these waters. And the South China Sea supports at least, what, 3.5 million people engaged directly in fishing, and the majority are small-scale fishers. So for China and the other nations, fishing is tied up in their national identity. And it's notable that by some estimates, China has anywhere from 500,000 to 800,000 fishing boats, accounting for nearly half of the world's fishing activity and at least 100,000 commercial trawlers. So there's really almost unanimous agreement among the survey respondents that fishery resources are being exploited at a harrowing rate, especially when some Chinese oversized trawlers are using dragnets large enough to swallow an entire football stadium. So with the fisheries collapsing, it's no wonder that there are increasing number of fishing vessels traveling into their neighbors' waters, and this contributes to rising fishing nationalism. So unchecked fishing practices are and remain a major threat to future fisheries unsustainability.
Thank you so much for that response. I guess I wanted to direct another question to Mr. Baker. A big theme that was mentioned was overfishing, but overall, your survey discusses the underlying environmental factors at play in the South China Sea. So I was wondering what other factors are at work and why should this be a point of concern?
Right. And what we found is that many people recognize factors that in the end are directly related to the availability of maritime protein and the sustainability of those key food stocks, quite a bit more than there was concern over oil and gas or mineral resources on the seafloor. But some of these elements, yes, we have the IUU fishing, we have overfishing, but there is destruction of mangroves, which are breeding and spawning areas and nursery areas. There is destruction of coral reefs, either physically through island building or poor fishing practices or through climactic issues. So ocean acidification, heating of the ocean, things that lead to what would be normally short-term bleaching cycles that may turn into sustained cycles of coral death and coral die-off. Those coral reefs are critical again as spawning areas, as feeding areas, as nursery areas for the fish, and even things like seagrass beds. And somewhat ironically, some of the coastal dynamics where you see the mangroves or the seagrasses being undermined is because of the establishment of aquaculture. So an attempt to mitigate the challenges of seafood availability actually further undermines the availability of seafood that's there. So I think those are some of the underlying issues. And as we start picking this apart, you can see each of these different threads. And I think one of the things that we wanted to emphasize, and that it certainly worked in this survey, through not only talking to scientists, but also talking to defense and security folks and policy folks, was the interconnectedness of these ideas of environmental security and traditional security's concerns and dynamics.
Thank you so much for outlining all of those issues. So now that we've established all of the conflicts at play, I wanted to now discuss the role of science diplomacy and cooperation. So Mr. Borton, in your book, Dispatches from the South China Sea, Navigating to Common Ground, you suggest that marine science cooperation is not only possible, but critical to peace building in the contested region. What is the significance of science cooperation, and how do you envision this looking in the future? And then as a follow-up to that, do the responses to your survey indicate a positive or negative future ahead?
There's a lot to unpack there in that question, but we are now in the UN decade of ocean science, and it offers a measurable opportunity for marine science cooperation or science and diplomacy to inform foreign policy decisions and to identify the common interest in spite of the national interest in the ocean. After all, science is a universal language, and so these claimant nation scientists understand the seriousness of the threats associated from acidification, the loss of biodiversity, the climate change, the destruction of coral reefs, and even the fishery collapse. But the stakes grow higher each day. And I mean, life cannot thrive without our oceans. And the coastal communities throughout the world, and especially true in the South China Sea region, are feeling the effects of these real-time changes, from the coral reef bleaching to the marine heat waves and the algae blooms. And all this impacts on the fisheries, the agriculture, the tourism, the marine ecosystems, all of which are essential for sustaining jobs, cultures, and for feeding people. The significance of the science cooperation is that these scientists understand that some forms of wealth belong to all of us, and that these community resources must be protected and managed for the good of all. And adopting this belief system is the way forward to what denationalized scientific research. So you ask me what I envision. I envision in the future, literally thousands of young citizen scientists in concert with these marine biologists from these marginalized coastal communities, monitoring their coastal marine ecosystems, participating in kind of a shared plastics pollution cleanups, and in developing new technologies for agriculture production to better feed their communities. Of course, I mean, there are some still real challenges in discovering innovative ways to get scientists to share their data and to map out a blueprint for environmental conservation and sustainability. Yet, I also envision, and in the near term, the creation of a South China Sea Blue Commission comprised of these leading marine scientists from all the claimant nations, as well as policy experts. I also think we're going to see more joint marine science expeditions, and these surveys are going to take place in the Spratlys. Even this year, it was suggested that Vietnam and the Philippines participate in a renewed joint marine expedition. I still believe that, I'm hopeful about that. And it's encouraging, in coming back to our survey, that the respondents believe that science cooperation would be valuable and may play a small part in managing these regional tensions.
Thank you so much for that response. That definitely outlined a very optimistic future for science cooperation. I wanted to direct the next question to Mr. Baker. I was wondering, have there been any regional or national efforts to establish sustainable science-driven cooperation, and have they been successful initiatives?
So there have been at different moments in time, as we just heard. There's the Joint Oceanographic and Maritime Scientific Research Expedition in the South China Sea, the mouthful there, the Jomsri SCS, between Vietnam and the Philippines. And remember, Vietnam and the Philippines both claim the bulk of the Spratly Islands. So they have direct competing claims over territory, maritime territory, fishing grounds, all of the challenges within that geography. And yet from the mid-90s until about 2007, they carried out these joint operations, joint research operations that would help them better assess the actual status of what was happening in those regions that would impact their fisheries and things of that sort. That stopped after 2007, but at the end of 2021, they agreed to start reestablishing those types of relationships and actions. And so I think that that's one of those key examples where we've seen science diplomacy at work. Science diplomacy doesn't solve geopolitical issues, but it does allow a certain amount of dialogue and it does allow connectivity. We saw it in the Cold War, the cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union in space, despite the fact that they were competing in space, right? And that space was, although not supposed to be weaponized, it was effectively weaponized as well. And yet there was that cooperation between the United States and the Soviets in space. You had space capsules hooking up together and really being able to overcome, at least in some levels, the strategic competition between them. And we've seen it since the end of the Cold War in the Arctic, although that's been really disrupted now, where the Arctic Council sort of was a facilitator of collaboration and cooperation on science and policy. It intentionally omitted issues of traditional security, and those issues were not to be discussed or to be addressed, and that allowed it to be more free. And it also then became a central space for non-Arctic states to work collaboratively with Arctic states in science and technology. And when we had the Russian-Ukraine war break out again, not only was there a disruption between the Europeans, the Americans, the Canadians, and the Russians in that science exchanges, it actually disrupted other countries' activities as well. South Korea, Japan, India, all of these countries had a disruption to that. So, you know, it doesn't solve everything, but we have seen examples of this. And I think the criticality of the idea of science diplomacy is that policy, strategic policy, national policy, without knowledge of the underlying science is going to be faulty. And science cooperation, without acknowledging and recognizing that there are these strategic issues, even if you don't want them to interrupt what you do, I think doesn't work. Both of them have to recognize the realities of each other, and that allows it to be able to work in a more collaborative and a more effective manner that can do things like manage fisheries in a place as complex as the South China Sea, where so many countries depend upon that source of protein. But if they only each carry out their own policies, it will be absolutely ineffective for all of them.
As a follow-up, I was wondering if the rise of climate change and rising temperatures would further exacerbate the need for a regional agreement, or do you anticipate any challenges?
I'll jump in first and then turn it over to James. But certainly, I mean, one of the biggest things we're seeing with climate change, not only are the impacts on reefs and things of that sort, but as the water temperature changes and at certain depths, we're seeing fish stock move. They move to a different geography. We're seeing that in the North Pacific. We saw it with squid up near North Korea and Japan, where then the North Korean ships started moving more and more into Japanese waters. The fish don't care about territorial boundaries. They do care about temperature. And there are critical temperatures for spawning. There are critical temperatures for their nurseries. And they will move to match where those temperatures and then substrate dynamics best fit their biology. And that means that traditional fishing grounds might not actually have the fish in them. They might be in another geography. And so as we watch impacts of changing climate, that impacts where and how these fish stocks exist, where they spawn, how fast they grow, what size they get to be, where they travel or don't travel. We're seeing it with salmon spawning as the streams are too warm. It's very difficult for the salmon to spawn, and that's going to have, you know, generational impacts, at least in terms of fish generations, right, on food stock, food availability stock. So I think that's one of the most critical aspects of climate change that directly impacts the raw biology of the fisheries and the fish foods and things of that sort that are going to require joint management because the fish are moving.
If I might add to that, in terms of climate change, it's a unifier among the Association of Southeast Asian Nations now. I mean, they are moving as quickly as they can to address these environmental issues. And they seem to be reaching agreement even on some of the water management issues. I think of even the Mekong River, their coastal communities, there's understanding there, the deforestation issues, land degradation. All of this is attributed to climate change. So it's bringing together this wider group of nations who may not always be in agreement on many, many other issues. The same is true in the last couple of years. We've seen maritime cooperation workshops, both in China and in Vietnam, and both respective countries have invited climate nation biologists, marine scientists to participate. So the examination of climate change is of great, great concern to those nations there.
Thank you so much for that response. As a follow-up question, both of you emphasized this idea of policy with the knowledge of the underlying science. I was wondering if that collaboration is feasible right now, or if you anticipate this as, you know, more of a gradual process.
This is where you'll probably find the slight differentiation between Mr. Borton and myself. I come from the field of geopolitics, biology before that, so that's why it's a great place to talk. There are significant constraints on this, and that is a reality, and it's very difficult. Frequently, when you think about a lot of the scientific activity, which may require government funding, and government funding will always be caught up in politics and international relations, as well as just raw economics. And so those challenges, I think, do exist. There's also a bit of a fear of, you know, I think that Mr. Borton referred to this earlier, a fear of sharing data, either as scientists who really want to make sure that they get to publish or perish, but also as nations that are increasingly seeing food security and economic security as direct components of national security, and therefore requiring more secrecy over that because it could potentially expose vulnerabilities to their opponents or their potential future enemies. So I think there are some serious challenges, just as we saw in the Arctic, where you had decades of effective cooperation that suddenly blew up in overnight, literally. That is challenging. It doesn't mean that it's impossible, but it does mean that, again, I think it's not only do policymakers have to be aware of science, scientists have to be aware of policy. They can't just go in assuming still that the world is flat and everybody is going to always work collaboratively, or assuming that simply asserting the science fact will change political positions.
Do you have any insights on that, Mr. Borton?
Well, I do not disagree with my colleague at all, but I think that there this urgency related to the environmental security issues, or translating that into food security, may provide the opening to denationalize even the sharing of data. In the communication that I've received more recently from Chinese oceanographers and one marine biologist, is that they seem to be imparting to me a sense that they're willing to share some of their data. And of course, there are obstacles with Beijing, and they're speaking as scientists, and we come back to this kind of universality of language. And the common ground is that those scientists, they share data in order to gather more knowledge. And so I believe that we can see breakthroughs in that. And the voices of the scientists, they're urgent voices today. And if we're not listening to them, we are indeed at that tipping point that I mentioned earlier. And the informed policy leaders, I believe that they're giving more ear, more voice, I should say, to their scientists in their communities. So that makes me hopeful. I am indeed hopeful.
Thank you both for those responses. So I wanted to wrap up our discussion, and I'm directing this question to both of you. I was wondering if either of you see potential in the South China Sea as a sea that unites rather than divides? And I was wondering if that idea was reflected in the survey.
I still see it right now, despite the the potential or cautious optimism, that for now there are still these concepts of division, and those are being driven by things that, well, they may not be bigger in the macro sense than the changing climate. They appear to be more immediate or more focused in many of these countries. We are seeing, though, in the concept of connecting, we are seeing, though, a maybe not everybody getting together, but we are seeing more collaboration, particularly within and among the ASEAN states. And we are seeing a greater willingness to bring in and directly involve outside countries who are not from that area. So the United States Coast Guard initiatives on IUU fishing has been very welcome, as opposed to the U.S. just coming in and telling countries what not to do. Now they're coming in and being collaborative. So in that sense, I think there is a greater element for cooperation. It may not be holistic cooperation. It may be small pockets of cooperation that we would be looking for within that area.
Let me just follow up real quickly here, is that I, you know, believe that cooperation is our only safeguard for food security and sustainable and economic development in the contested region. But, you know, we really did not tease out in greater detail about the role of science diplomacy, because, you know, the actions are really designed to directly advance a country's national needs. It doesn't come at the expense of nationalism. It's part of it. It's a component. And there are also actions designed to address the cross-border interest. So again, the actions primarily are designed to meet the global needs and challenges. That's all part of the total picture. So with that in mind, I think that this level of aspiration towards cooperation in our oceans is something that is achievable. And we better go at it now more than ever. Thank you.
Those are all the questions I have for you both today, but thank you so much for your time and for speaking with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Asia Unscripted. You can find the U.S. Asia Institute on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. This and all of the U.S. Asia Institute's podcasts are made possible in part by the support from our sponsors, SANS, FedEx, AIG, ConocoPhillips, Fairfield Maxwell, Walmart, and others.